Welcome to Eat, Sleep, Wine, Repeat, a podcast for all you wine lovers who, if you're like me, just cannot get enough of the good stuff. I'm Yanina Doyle, your host, brand ambassador, wine educator, and sommelier. So stick with me as we dive deeper into this ever-evolving, wonderful world of wine. And wherever you are listening to this, cheers to you. Hello, wine friends, and welcome back to another episode where today we are focusing on the Southern Rhone region and digging deeper. So this is part two with stage two Master of Wine student Anna Spooner, who has actually moved to live in the Southern Rhone. So this specific episode, we're going to be focusing on Côte de Rhone, Côte de Rhone Village, the crews. What does that all mean? We'll be looking at the most famous crew, Châteauneuf de Pape, and how does that compare to Gigondas? We'll talk about a region called Ventoux, which is very interesting, quite up and coming, and definitely a region to know about. And Anna's going to be talking about the lesser known areas, places where we can find value, where to visit. Now, don't forget, there's always a transcript to each episode. So if we're mentioning regions and you want to know how they're spelt, just go to my show notes and you'll find the link. Or you can go to my website, www.eatsleepwinerepeat.co.uk/podcasts. And if you have not visited Wickham's Wine yet, the link is also in my show notes. They are the sponsor of this season. And being Decanter's best specialist retailer for South and regional France, this is the time to grab yourself a Rhone Valley wine from them, pour it out, and listen to the episode. Don't forget to use my code EATSLEEP10 for 10% off your first order. Right, let's discuss these villages and the crews of the Southern Rhone. What I'd love to do is just differentiate for anybody who thinks that the Rhone Valley is just the Rhone Valley. We are going to talk today about Southern Rhone, but could you just very quickly touch on why Northern Rhone is actually so different from the Southern Rhone, so people understand why you're getting bigger flavours, or why typically the Southern Rhone is famous traditionally for bigger, heavy reds and whites?
I will do so in a storytelling as opposed to stats.
Yes, please.
I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about how many grapes are permitted in each, but the really basic overview of grapes, first of all, is that in the Northern Rhone, Syrah is the only real red grape that you can make cru wine or equivalent of. In the south, I've already mentioned, Grenache dominates, but you also get Syrah and you get Mourvèdre as well. I would also say that one of the key things for me is not only that with the red wines, but the white wines, there's again that level of flexibility is actually a little bit higher in the Northern Rhone. You have Viognier for somewhere like Condroux, but you also have Marsan and Roussan. We're not talking massive flexibility, but we're talking some flexibility. In the south, I've already mentioned the grape varieties, so you can kind of get an idea already. The south has a bigger menu. You've got a lot more to choose from in the Southern Rhone. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to use it. You might end up still making a wine that matches the grape varieties of the north. But the southern has a bigger menu. And so the variation in the north, in fact, comes from more the soils. So you imagine it's like Burgundy, where you're planting Pinot Noir the whole time. So the main difference is going to be where are you planting it and how are you planting it and how are you making it, not which grape is going into it. Your raw materials, you've limited one factor. So in the north, things like aspect and soil type become really critical. So you have things like granite outcrops in Hermitage versus slightly down the hill of Croix-Hermitage, you have more sand and clay. And things like that can bear a huge difference on the grape. And I'm not saying you can taste granite or you can taste sand and clay, but because of things like the water holding properties of those soils, nutrient efficiencies or deficiencies, all sorts of things, because of that classic terroir statement, that becomes very important in the north. Not to say that it isn't important in the south, but the soils are very varied in the south. So each appellation is not maybe as generic. You also have some key, it's much bigger in the south. So the north you can kind of think of as a very lovely, thin, long corridor of slopes. And the south is a lot more varied. But when you, I mean, again, if you throw in Mont Ventoux, we just start to go into a crazy amount of very, very different terroir. If we've got time, we can talk about that in a bit. But for the Cruz alone, you have the limestone outcrop, which is in the south, the Dentelle de Montmirail, which are very beautiful mountains. Great for hiking. If anybody's a big adventurer, explorer, it's a beautiful place for hiking, biking, rock climbing. And those are limestone. So you have your Gigondas, your Baume de Venise in the foothills of Acoas, and then kind of plopping along from that down in the valleys a bit more, you have Rastoux, Curran. So you've already got a differentiation there. You then go into this dogleg in the more plain by the river with alluvial soils where you start to find Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Tavel, Lirac, the new appellation Laudon, which is about this year. So it's a new, as of this vintage, you had it here first, new crew.
That's going to be, am I right, the 10th? I think there's nine. There's nine crews.
This will be number 10 for the south. Right. So there's eight in the north and this will make it 10 in the south. That includes, it's worth saying in the south, that includes the two Vins du Naturel appellation as well. So they have their own appellation. So there's Baume de Venise for still dry wines. And then there's Muscat de Baume de Venise for the Vin du Naturel. Yeah. So there's going to be 10 total cru in the south. Well, there are now. It's this year. And the wine's made from the 2023 vintage, I believe. And I must apologize because I've actually only heard it said a couple of times, Laudon. And I'm not totally convinced I actually know how to say it. Because it's not as maybe recognized or well known. So it was a Côte d'Aron village. So the way that the promotion works is it's like a pyramid. You start at Côte d'Aron, then you go to Côte d'Aron village, then you go to Côte d'Aron village with the name. So this was Côte d'Aron village Laudon. And then you get all of the Côte d'Aron blah, blah, blah removed and it goes just to the name because you're kind of deemed that you're good enough that you don't even need to be known. It's not Côte d'Aron village Châteauneuf-du-Pape. Gosh. Wouldn't have enough room on a label.
No.
So there's that. But there's the two main differences from almost a visual, but actually the growing conditions point of view. If you leave soil out of it slightly, because soil is variable across both, if you leave soil out of it, then really the main things are slopes. Everybody says the Southern Rhone is flat. That's clearly not true. I've just explained you can go hiking up some mountains where Gigondas is grown. If you work a harvest in the Southern Rhone, you're going to get a suntan. If you work a harvest in the Northern Rhone, you're going to get a bad back. There's really steep slopes of the Northern Rhone. Those are defining of place. Yes, okay, Croisé-Métage is slightly lower and Saint-Joseph is slightly more undulating. But overall, slopes are important. But also with them being slightly more northerly, the weather really is different. There is more rain. The temperature is cooler, considerably cooler. And although it's not flat, flat down south, more undulating for sure, rather than steep. And then the other thing, really other than that, is the north has less effect of Mistral, the big wind, although I'm sure in the north some days they would argue they still get it. But in the south, my goodness, that is where the textbook is correct. They say, oh, the Mistral wind. Actually, do you know what? There are days when I can't open my car door because the Mistral is blowing so much.
No!
Yeah, okay. Where I'm like, oh, push, push, push. So it is real, yes. So don't think, oh, how much can a wind affect my wine? It's amazing. It's a doctor. It gets rid of disease. But my goodness, it makes the growing conditions, hard work, things have to be trained differently. If you're training a vine differently, it will grow in a certain way. You have to have certain varieties that can withstand it. Grenache happens to have a really rigid, fat trunk. You know, there's a reason Grenache is ideal in the Southern Rhone. And I've already mentioned the temperature and the drought, but the Mistral is another one. You can't put a flimsy, beautiful, you know, slim, gorgeous vine here. It's going to blow over in a second. So we have to have our incredible witch's fingers.
And you talked about the fact that the way the vines are trellised. So actually, I think Châteauneuf-du-Pape, well, it's the most famous cru anyway. It's the original cru. But actually, when people Google maybe images of the Southern Rhone, I would imagine a lot of the time they will get an image of these bush vines, these big, fat, gnarly bush vines, and with the pudding stones. So actually, and you get them across actually the southern Rhone in different areas. So actually that might be a really good one just to talk about that so people can kind of maybe imagine what they would see.
Yeah. If you imagine the northern Rhone is a big V and you have got granite, you've got sand, clay, you've got some limestone, you've got a real combination, but you can almost imagine that the rocks are kind of like much finer, the sort of slope where you'd walk down and slip. In the southern Rhone, it's Châteauneuf-du-Pape is a particularly good example of this because it's flatter. So it's an old, effectively an old riverbed. So it's alluvial soil. By that, I mean that it was part of the riverbed. It was actually part of a sea, some of it. But the stones are round because of constant erosion, so water passing over them, which has softened them up. There's obviously no water there now. Very old soils and very nutrient deficient, actually. That's a big challenge. Obviously, those stones don't continue down. And there are other soils underneath it. And those are usually a combination of clay and all sorts of other things. But those pudding stones do a job in that they reflect heat. So interestingly, pudding stones that were once so trendy to try and get these high alcohol wines of the 80s that everybody adored are actually not as popular as you might think now. Now, it's the classic photo moment. So you see the bush vines growing on the pudding stones. They're low to the ground. So if you imagine the sunlight is hitting those pudding stones, reflecting up, because they're these lovely white big rocks, reflecting up, giving these, you know, grapes the glow up. But then they also store the heat. So in the night, you get this kind of like constant warm energy helping the grapes to ripen. Grenache used to need that. And now with climate change, it's just not that necessary anymore. So I think it's worth flagging. Pudding stones does not equal best quality wine, but it certainly is the kind of cool, it's the hallmark picture card moment of the Southern Rhone. And there are plenty of other places in the Southern Rhone that have those pudding stones. So there's a village, Côte de Rhone village, Plan de Dieu, which is based around a few villages like Travaillon and a few others. And that's full of pudding stones. You know, you drive down, you could be in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. The soils underneath are slightly different and it's not got the same elevation to cru, but it certainly can produce a similar style of wine. And those do tend to be the higher alcohols. So those pudding stones can often equal high alcohols, which you need to know how to manage them these days.
So do you think then that, let's say the other cru, Gigondas, which was very often named as, wasn't it, the poor man's Châteauneuf-du-Pape, it wasn't as big, it wasn't as bold. That's actually probably massively helping Gigondas now. I mean, I think they've got similar regulations, strict requirements that they have to follow. They're very similar. But actually now I think they're harder to tell apart, aren't they?
Yeah, and actually, do you know what? Gigondas is probably, in my opinion, where you can find the best value for money in the premium wines of the Southern Rhone. Consistently high quality across most of the producers there. It's always played second fiddle. And I do think stylistically, there are some similarities to be found, but there are also some major differences. So the alcohols do tend to be lower, which is great and obviously increasingly popular. They have a little more freshness. So the elevations there can vary, but let's say 400 meters is a pretty good point of context. But they go all up these Dentelle de Montmirail slopes. So it kind of depends which producer and which vineyards. But you are definitely talking about an elevation that is much higher than Châteauneuf. And I've mentioned it slightly already, I think. They have some shading. So the Dentelle actually provide a real shady area that, again, historically not very popular. We want sunshine, sunshine, sunshine. And now people are seeking out those little parcels. So I think, yes, quality-wise, you know, if you were going on quality alone, Gigondas, Châteauneuf-du-Pape, they're beating the same drum for sure. But I do think stylistically where Châteauneuf-du-Pape is struggling in terms of having to work harder to get freshness, Gigondas has the luxury of having nature provide some extra freshness for it because of that elevation, because of the shading. So Châteauneuf-du-Pape producers are amazing in general as a rule. So they can do it. If anyone can do it, they can do it. They can invest, they can find the right, it can come down to things as simple as leaf shading, you know, whether they cut the canopies, etc., to ensure that the Grenache doesn't get sunburnt. So there are plenty of techniques they can use. But I think increasingly with temperatures rising in the region, Gigondas is probably going to have the edge. Personal opinion,
Gigondas gets a big tick. But what about Baccaras? Which, because if somebody was to look at a map of the southern Rhone, they would see that Baccaras is right next door to Gigondas. And I guess, I think in the past, that crew still had a bit of a reputation for being a little bit more rustic. But I think presumably now, again, with all producers sharing knowledge, learning, doing all these things in the vineyard, I mean, do you feel that that's still slightly...
Really, if you're picking apart details here, because you can get people that make incredibly elegant Baccaras that you would think taste like Gigondas. But if you're really picking apart the details again of the raw materials, then Baccaras has lower elevation, so tends to be a little warmer. But bear in mind that 100 meters is 1 degree Celsius. So we talk, even if we're talking about 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, that can make a difference in a growing season where things are warm. We've got lower elevation. We've also got slightly different soils. So the soils in Gigondas are lighter. They tend to be limestone sand-based. And Baccaras stops being as influenced by that limestone outcrop, the Dentelle de Montmirail. It's further set back from that outcrop. So actually what you end up with there is, rustic's a challenging word, isn't it? It's a bit like when we were talking about Greek earlier. What does rustic really mean? But what you do have for sure is a kind of density, a richness, at times that less elegant and finesse. But I hate to use like less elegant and finesse because that makes it sound like it's less good.
Yeah,
it's just different. Yeah, it's just different. And if you do get the opportunity to taste them side by side, particularly from the same producer, I mentioned Clos de Cazaux earlier, who make the 100% Claret white wine. They have vineyards in both Gigondas and Baccaras, and I host tours in the Southern Rhone, and I often take people to Clos de Cazaux because it's a great one to taste a range of wines grown a few hundred meters apart, but on different soils from different crew. And they're a beautiful producer for that example, you know. There's lots of producers will say, oh, we make a Côte de Rhone and we make a Châteauneuf, we make a Gigondas. And it's like, yeah, but they're from very different parts of the region. Whereas this producer is a, you know, it's an estate producer. They can see or drive very close distances to all their vineyards, but they are on that boundary and they recognize that boundary is real. The soil changes enough for them to say, yes, our wines are different because of the change in the soil and the change in the aspect and slope.
I think those kind of experiences with wine really open up your eyes. This is what, and it's not just, that's the geekiness in us. That's what we're looking for. But when we're trying to explain to consumers why you might go for one crew rather than another, it's so wonderful for them, even if they struggle to describe the wine, it doesn't matter. They're going to see that, oh, this one is darker, this seems darker and more plush, and this one seems brighter. And then, you know, that's, oh, okay, wow, you know, texture's different, yeah. Structure's different. Oh, you know, it's fascinating.
And so, you know, if you wanted to be really basic in terms of drinking occasion, which I think can help sometimes get people into where do these wines sit. For me, Gigondas is quite an autumnal wine. You can use it when you're transitioning into winter. Okay, I'm really talking broad brush strokes, generalizations here. But Baccaras moves into that winter wine. It tends to be something that you have with more like stews rather than leaner cuts of meat. And again, huge generalizations, and it comes down to personal preference, but there is a difference.
Okay. There really is. And now you said you take people on tours. First of all, if somebody wanted to have a tour with you, if they went to your website, they could then just send you an email and say, Anna,
yes,
take us out. Right.
I'd say I'd love to.
What's your website, by the way? I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but what is your website?
I like to keep things simple. So it's literally just www.annaspoonerwine.com, all one word.
I don't know if I'll remember that. But anyway, yeah, links below. So anyway, do you adapt the tours all the time to people's preferences, or do you have some pretty defined routes that you love to take people out on?
No. So what I do is I do a pre-tour interview. That sounds way more formal than it is.
Oh, gosh, I'm a bit scared now. Okay.
No, I will ask you a few questions over an email. Some clients I do a Zoom with if they're more comfortable. Sometimes it's a couple and they'll be, you know, on an email chain. I've had great groups before where it's actually easier rather than an awful email chain of 10 people replying. It's easier to just all jump on a Zoom call, you know, at a time that suits. And it's much better for me to understand what you want out of an experience. It's certainly, and this is definitely not a negative, some people will love to go to a winery because of the views and they want to take a walk in the vineyards, which I obviously love doing. And they want to see the incredible sights, or they want to be able to take that photo, you know, with the Mont Ventoux in the background, or take a photo holding the pudding stones or whatever it looks like. And that is fine. I'm really okay with that. I love doing that too. But some people would actually much rather do, as I just mentioned, say, I really want to be able to taste, I want to learn the difference between Vacheresse and Gigondas by the end of this trip. Or I want to know what these grape varieties taste like. Or I want to know who the up and coming producers are that none of my friends have heard of. And there is no one size fits all for a tour. I think anybody that sells you a tour package is having you on, because, you know, I remember going to Franschhoek in South Africa for the first time. And my friends that I was with said, can we go on the wine tram? And I said, yeah, cool. It's an amazing experience. But I said, as a wine professional, I would like to make my own tour. Yeah. And luckily, you can pay people like me to do that for you. So you don't have to do the thinking. You can offload to me and tell me, and I can do the work and do the research. So I've kind of basically designed my business based on what I want out of my wine tours, really.
Well, now I'm going to lead you into talking about Ventoux, because you've mentioned this several times now. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but I have a sneaky suspicion that this area is close to your heart. You seem to really have an affiliation with this area.
Yeah, I think probably because it's a place that less people know about. They might have seen it on the Tour de France. My husband's a very keen cyclist, and we come at our love of Mont Ventoux from two very, very different directions.
I go with your one. I prefer your one.
Yeah, I've certainly never biked up to the top of it, but he loves to, and is an incredible place, full stop. It's beautiful. It looks like it's got snow on it all year round, but it's actually limestone, pure limestone at the top.
Okay.
So everybody assumes it is high, don't get me wrong, but everybody assumes it's really, really, really high and constantly got snow on it. That's limestone. But the really amazing thing is it's got this kind of convection current which pulls cool air down from the top and takes it down to the lower parts, which is where the vineyards are. And that in itself is probably why I'm the most interested, not because I'm completely obsessed with climate change, but because I certainly want to promote and preserve this region. And I don't think with the current trends in the world of wine to lower alcohols, fresher styles, that this region can deliver consistently in the way that it has. I don't think that we can assume that every Châteauneuf du Pape from now on is going to be delicious, because they are battling with 17% potential alcohol. Like, that's an impossible feat. And so calling a spade and recognizing that, hey, we might need to rethink what the Southern Rhone looks like and our expectations of it. And Ventoux for me is a region that's doing that. Vermentino I mentioned earlier, the wines that are made from Vermentino and Mont Ventoux, I would never have thought they were from the Rhone Valley. I love being here and going out for lunch in the summer. And I used to always go for rosé because, you know, I'd always thought the whites around here were a little bit warm, you know, I'm talking sort of 8-9 years ago. And I was like, oh, they're high alcohols and they're big and they over-oak them sometimes. And if they don't over-oak them, they're oily from Viognier, Marsan, Roussan, etc. And that's just not true anymore. You can get these amazing, rich, luscious winter wines from whites, but a Vermentino from Mont Ventoux, you could be on an Italian Riviera, you could be drinking. It's the sort of wine that would go in many ways with things like, Muscadet-style dishes. So seafoods and really light pastas, it's a new frontier in every respect. It's a new frontier. Janice Robinson actually said years ago now, so I'm obviously late to the party. But years ago, she said, if there was one part of the world, somebody asked her if there was one place in the world you could buy a vineyard, where would it be? And she said Mont Ventoux. I mean, she might have changed her mind by now, but I certainly would. I can understand in every respect the beauty of it, the potential quality wine, as well as the quality wine being made there. And the other cool thing about Ventoux is because it is this satellite region, so it doesn't have all the same rules and regulations, you get a lot of IGP wines that have complete flexibility. So there's Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc being grown there, all sorts of things. But there is also a really nice role, I should say. Vermentino is traditional here, so that's not zigging where others are zagging quite as much, whereas Sauvignon Blanc probably, I would say, is a pretty enormous zig against a zag. But there are amazing wines that are using the local varieties and the traditional varieties too, but just making them in a really different style. So for anybody who's looking to experience a version of the Southern Rhone that sits outside of probably most people's comfort zone, but not in a scary way, you're not going to, you know, there are things like orange wines and amazing natural wines, and there is that cool stuff going on, but also there's just really, 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 really good quality stuff that doesn't fit in the parameters that we usually have for the Southern Rhone.
And what about pricing? Do you feel that you get really good value here? Or again, is it starting to go up?
No, you can. And the nice thing about Ventoux is you can find a bit of everything. So our wedding wine, my husband and I last year, was not even bag and box, rack, where you put the petrol pump into a plastic container. We decanted it into bottles and served it the next day. So we did that, and it was something like €4.95 a litre Ventoux white.
Wow.
That we used.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was a good quality wine in my opinion. But likewise, there are wines that I've tried from Ventoux. I'm doing a tasting week after next at £67 with a great private client who wanted to explore exactly this topic. And we've got some amazing fine wines from Ventoux, but they are fine wines, bearing in mind properly fine wines, for around 32 UK retail. But if you were to compare that quality level with even, I would hate to say Burgundy because it's always, what can you even compare with Burgundy these days? But even, you know, comparing it with just some other fine wines of France, the Loire, let's say, you would certainly be expecting like £10 more. So definitely value to be found in Ventoux, definitely, definitely.
Do you have tips for anybody else searching for value in other parts of the Southern Rhone? Is it to find the satellites, or do you have a favourite crew that is not Chateauneuf du Pape?
So I mentioned Gigondas was great for a premium value, whatever you want to take of that sentence, which is awful. But in terms of if you want top of the tree quality, but you don't want to pay a Chateauneuf price, go to Gigondas, because that really does for me still represent value for money at the top quality tree. But yeah, satellites are great. You also have to kind of seek out interesting producers more than anything in the Southern Rhone. So there's a producer, whose name has just escaped me. It's a couple from Burgundy who've moved down here, and they're just basically playing around in a Côte de Rhône appellation and making incredible wines. I'll remember it and send it to you. Maybe pop it in the notes.
Or it might come to you any second now.
It might come to me, I'm thinking. But also, you, obviously having feet on the ground helps me with this, but Côte de Rhône Village and Côte de Rhône wines, if you are buying those from a producer that tends to make cru wines, I think those are excellent value. Now, there's two reasons for that. One is that if they're making wines and selling them for £25 a bottle in Vacheras, and then they're making a Côte de Rhône for £8.95 a bottle, chances are the winemaker's probably making both, because other than your big boys, the players in the Southern Rhone aren't huge. So you're probably getting a top quality winemaker making both wines. So that's a really good place to start. The other reason it's often very good is, I mentioned earlier about when people have vineyards next to each other. The Southern Rhone is farmer's country. You know, this isn't your Grand Chateau of Bordeaux. This isn't your small but very expensive mini micro plots in Burgundy. These are inherited vineyards from family. You might buy up a parcel from next door, but it's quite a kind of traditional region. And because of that, there's actually a really interesting strip of Côte de Rhône vineyards that are, there's an amazing producer called Claude de Caillou who makes Chateauneuf du Pape. And the owner was a big hunter, you know, three generations ago or whatever. And they had on their land forests for him to be able to hunt his wild boar. But they were planted forests, and they decided not to rip them up to allow for this wild boar hunting. And so when the inspectors effectively came round to delineate Châteauneuf du Pape, they were like, okay, well, these vineyards are all making great wine because of this particular soil, but this is a forest, so this won't be included. Now that the forest has been taken down, they've worked out that actually it should have probably been Châteauneuf du Pape all along.
Interesting.
So there are also these incredible, so Claude de Cailloux is the name of that producer. So there are these incredible stories, and they're not the only one. There's almost like a band that runs next to Châteauneuf du Pape where, you know, it's Côte de Rhône wine. And I'm so frustrated because I visited them before Christmas with my arrogance, thinking I'd buy some nice bottles for Christmas. And of course they're all sold out, because once you know the secret, once you know the tip.
Well, then don't be telling anyone else.
And again, you've got similar stories. So you've got a winemaker who's making a 50, 60, 70 pound Châteauneuf du Pape, who will also be managing, if not actually making, a 12 pound Côte de Rhône. So it's funny. Rhône is a place where you can sniff out the truffles. No okay. pun intended, obviously.
I was going to say, literally speaking. Yeah, exactly. But now tell me, because actually you also have done a harvest in one of the villages, right? Not in a crew. So where was that?
So that, I actually mentioned them earlier, because they're the people that have the two rosés side by side. So it's a Côte de Rhône village named Segure. And again, if you're fancying a trip to the region, Segure is just about the most beautiful place on the planet. It's always named one of the top most beautiful picturesque villages in France. It's set into, so the same kind of limestone outcrop that I mentioned, where Gigondas, it's got Baume de Venise on one side, Gigondas on the other. You then have Vacarès down the bottom. That sort of peters off from the actual limestone, but the formation itself moves into these undulating, the crew basically. So you've got like the Rastos and the Carans along. Segure sits in a similar line to those. Built into, literally into the rock face, is this incredible artist commune village called Segure.
Wow.
And I felt blessed to have that as my commute every day. So you drive up this windy track, you see the village incredibly in the rock, and then you dip over the top of that into another valley. And Segure is a very, very small, well, Côte de Rhône Village Segure, if you really want to give it its full title, is this tiny appellation that makes amazing wine, you know, real bang for the buck stuff. And interestingly, I was having a chat with a few people, and there's always politics when you're trying to get elevated to a crew. Because generally what happens in France is they don't take every producer along. So they'll have a quota, and number's not my strong point, but something like 75% are allowed to go through, but the rest get downgraded to Côte de Rhône. So you've worked your way up the tiers of the tree, but the final leap to become a crew, you have to effectively have approval of everyone, because some people won't make it through. And it's all very political, and it's different regions have different rules and regulations. But a lot of people feel that that's maybe why Segure hasn't been promoted yet. There are some really famous vines there, some amazing old vines, particularly at the producer I worked with, which was one of the reasons I loved it. And it's honestly this pocket of beauty. So yeah, Morchon is the name. They make very, very bold GSM blends, but that are beautifully balanced. They make two whites, two rosés, and they actually make a sweet wine, but it's not a VDN. They make a really light, gorgeous sweet wine.
Is it fortified?
It's not, no. Okay, so that's what's interesting. It's actually sweet. Just mm-hmm. a sweet Viognier, if I remember correctly.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, it's lovely. And it's just a bit of fun, really. But I love that spot so much, genuinely, that we had our wedding service there as well. The following year or 2 years later.
Amazing. So everyone can go and visit this winery. You can take them to the winery, yes. And people can get married. Well, not married there. They can have.
You can stay there. You can get married there. You name it. You can do it there. You can. It's an incredible spot. But the wines are amazing. And doing a harvest there was one of the highlights of my life, really.
No, honestly, now I'm like, please, I really want to get there. So I'm now thinking, honestly, I'm like, God, I need to go to the Rhone Valley. I haven't, or Southern Rhone. Lots of people listening are going to be thinking exactly the same thing now, because you've got us so, so excited. So what's a good itinerary? What's a good plan to aim for? Like, where should we fly in? What's the minimum amount of days that someone could take off work, because let's be honest, we don't all have a month and or a year, or just move there. So where do we fly into?
So there's a few options. You used to be able to fly into Avignon, which is basically the town, the city of the Southern Rhone. And it's worth visiting. So whilst I'm on the point of Avignon, it's worth doing a stop off in Avignon, even just to do a morning. Or there's obviously the Pope's Palace, which is where Chateauneuf du Pape gets its name, because the only time the Pope has not been based in the Vatican was when the papal was based in Avignon. And the Pope's new home was Chateauneuf du Pape, where he used to grow wine and have a lovely time. So it's just a hop, skip and a jump between Avignon and Chateauneuf du Pape. So that's great. They might bring back those flights, but assuming that they don't, you can get the TGV, which is the train down to Avignon. So you can get on at London, change at Paris. You used to be able to do it all in a one-off. You can't now. Please bring that back. But you just have to change station in Paris, which is lovely. You can break it up and have lunch, maybe. A lunch in Paris. But you zoom down the TGV and it's a really beautiful train journey, actually, because you basically go through all of Burgundy. You don't quite see the Northern Rhone in quite the same way as if you drive, but it's still gorgeous. But the easiest really is to fly to Marseille, because there's so many flights to Marseille. You can also probably just enjoy a bit of bouillabaisse or have some seafood. You can make a thing of the actual part of Marseille as well. But it's about an hour and 10, hour and 15 from Marseille up to the Rhone. So it's really not far. And from there, I would say you really want to spend, in my opinion, 4 days. 4 days is great. Lots of people do a kind of fleeting visit. There's loads of river tours in the Rhone, and they might only spend a day in the vineyards here. And I don't think that is enough. But if you're doing that, great. But I think 4 days would give you enough to do a bit of culture in Avignon. If you wanted to dip into the Provence, you can do things, something like go to Aix. Really not far. I mean, I live a little bit further from Aix now because we've gone slightly further north of my parents. But, you know, 40 minutes, give or take, to Aix-en-Provence. We'll go drink some of that style rosé, come back, try the Rhone stuff. But the main thing I'd say is you can do vineyards. The food is really great and very, very good value. It's where dairy stops being as much of a big thing. So you're going to get more those olive oil based dishes, very Mediterranean, but quality is just exceptional and value for money, as I mentioned. So food you want to do, wine you want to do. I would, if you are physically able, certainly try and do a little bit of walking and exploring. There are some really nice, you know, bike rides if you're so inclined. Electric bikes are huge here, hiking as well. And then I think because of that, that might affect the time of year to visit. So timing wise, May is great. June is great. And if you are visiting in June, you might get the lavender, which is beautiful. And if you miss the lavender, don't worry, because you can get the sunflowers later. There's always something beautiful as well as the gorgeous vines. It does get very, very hot though. So if you're not someone that deals well with heat, do avoid July and August. And maybe start coming back in late September and October when the leaves of the vines change colour here. It's unbelievable.
Oh God, listen, you are selling it. Are you on the Southern Rhone board? Have they paid you for this?
There's a reason that I chose to move. Yeah, I chose to move here for good reason. It's got the weather, it's got the outdoors lifestyle. Yeah, what I haven't mentioned is we're recording this on the 5th of January and it rained today and it shocked me. We've probably had 5 days of rain since October.
It offended you, did it? How dare it?
Yeah. And I do know we need rain. That's fine. But when it rains heavily, and it will rain very heavily for a day or 2 days. But it's other than that, you should expect good weather for lots of the year. So there's no wet season to avoid per se.
Love it. Honestly, I've got so excited about the thought of what I'm going to do when I come visit. Is there actually one specific village that is a perfect place to base yourself, or does it not really matter?
I think it's worth, for anyone who's more familiar with visiting somewhere like Bordeaux, that it's not really like that. So the villages are quite spread out. You will probably need a car or a tour guide, or there are certain villages where there's a higher density of wineries. So, for example, if you stayed in Gigondas, you could walk to several. If you stayed at Baume de Venise, some. But if you stayed even Van Sobe, it would be much harder. It's another cru, but it'd be much harder. Châteauneuf-du-Pape is a fair place to base yourself. Avignon as well. Vaison-la-Romaine is a lovely town. They have an amazing market. Well, two markets a week, actually. Vaison is less well known, but is bustling and you can go for dinner in the evenings. That's one thing I should really flag to people. The French around here, because it's very much an agricultural area, they have lunch and a lot of restaurants will only be open at lunch and then early dinners.
Actually, that suits me. I've got to that age now where if I eat past like 7:30, I'm not going to sleep. You know, it's like...
Yeah, have a big lunch and relax for the afternoon by the swimming pool, I think. But no, so it's just worth, if you are looking to then go out in the evening and go for dinner, you need to pick somewhere bigger like Aix, Avignon or Vaison. But really, if you wanted to get right under the skin of it, you could stay in one of the small villages and use it as a base. And any of them have beautiful views. You know, you could just literally put a pin on the map in this part of the world and you'd be somewhere rather special. So
basically go to booking.com, just literally see that area, put in the cheapest price and go, that'll do.
That will do.
Whatever's 9 stars and less than 60, 70 pound a night, take it.
Yeah. Great anyway. Hotels, great rentals. And that's another good thing. But eating out and drinking out, just be aware that don't expect hustle and bustle. It's an agricultural area, so it's not like the city of Bordeaux where you could go to a wine bar and stay there till 11 p.m. You would need to plan that sort of thing and certainly go to somewhere a bit busier.
I love it. We all need places where we can just switch off and take it that little bit slower.
So exactly.
It sounds to me like this is perfect for anyone wanting to wind down and just stimulate the senses.
All the senses can be stimulated here. I can assure you of that.
Love it. Anna, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Like, right. I'm really inspired genuinely to come to the Rhone Valley now. So you've done a fabulous job of storytelling. I'm going to come and see you and come and walk the dogs with you.
Please do. Please
Love
do.
Oh, perfect. Right. Well, I'll look at the flights and I'll let you know.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, loved it. I'll speak to you very soon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, taking you across to Italy for next week, join me as we delve into the captivating world of super Tuscan wines. So I'm going to be exploring their origins, the pioneers behind it. I'm sure many of you have heard of Sassicaia. What about Tignanello? Ornellaia, and what about Masetto? So we're going to be talking about all of these superstar wineries that have changed the Italian wine industry. And as ever, I shall finish with a wine quote. Well, maybe this one's actually a little bit more like a social media caption, but nonetheless, it says, "Sipping on dreams and red wine." Well, I guarantee you we'll be doing that next week. But until then, may this week be filled with positivity and inspiring moments and make you happy. That's it. If you are enjoying these episodes, don't forget to like, share, subscribe, leave a review, especially if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, because you know that's the rule and it helps the podcast become more discoverable. Go and see if you can find yourself a super Tuscan for next week. Maybe not as expensive as Sassicaia, but there are some good value ones out there. And I'll see you here back next Monday. Until then, wine friends, cheers to you.